Zoe Lyons, ladies and gentlemen. First of all, is there a better show business name than Zoe Lyons?
Do you think it's good?
I think it's absolutely perfect.
Do you?
Yeah.
I've never really thought about it.
Those are probably two of the best names ever. Like if you had one of those magnet jumbles of names.
I've done quite well.
On the fridge.
Yeah.
And you were trying to find a perfect showbiz name.
Zoe Lyons. Never really thought about it. Like, I guess because it's my name, I don't overanalyze it. But I was once introduced on stage as Josie Loins. Yeah, Zoe Lyons is not a difficult name, but they managed to mangle it into Josie Loins.
Tom Rhodes has been fucked up. I've had Tim Reeds,
yeah.
Tom Rose.
Yeah. It's hard to do a gig once you've been introduced as Loins, though. It is, because that's all you've got in your head then, just Loins is quite a visual word. And they're thinking Loins, I'm thinking Loins. And then Josie Loins, you think it's just too close to Juicy. And, yeah.
Juicy Loins.
Loins.
That would be
that
a
would
good
be my porn name.
Yeah.
That would be my porn name. Hi, I'm Juicy Loins. Yeah.
But now here we are at the tail end of the Edinburgh Fringe Festival.
Yeah.
And I have to say, Tom Rhodes Radio gives Zoe Lyons Mustard Cutter 5 stars.
Thank you, my darling.
One of the best shows I saw of the entire month.
Oh, that's very sweet of you to say. I really appreciate that.
I'm absolutely sincere.
Yeah.
Your style, your material, and you got a certain energy. It's not like it's not like high energy, someone jumping around the stage like a Robin Williams, but like
it's pretty physical though. I think I'm pretty physical for a female performer. I think that's kind of it is a bit more unusual to see a woman embody material like I do. I guess
you acted out.
I acted out. Yeah.
I think that's the secret to everything.
Yeah. Yeah. Because it's what I'm good at. I guess in a different time, in a different space, in a century, I'd have been that slightly weird looking Russian clown. That's what I think I would have been. You know, sort of the hooded jester that came into the town, pulled a few faces and strutted about a bit. I remember once seeing a Russian theatre group here years ago in Edinburgh. And what they did on stage, I realised was what I was meant to do. I was like, I'm meant to be a Russian clown. That's what I'm meant to be. It was so beautiful.
Are you from a performing family, or this is just like your childhood fantasy?
Yeah, there's nothing like that in my family at all. I've just always known I can pull faces and pull physical poses that can make people laugh as well. And I stopped doing it within my comedy for many years because I thought it looked undignified. There was a bit of me that over-questioned it. It went, you now look ridiculous. And it was my partner who actually said to me, don't, you've got to do what you're good at. And that's what you're good at. Is embodying it, so that's what I do.
Thank God for a smart partner.
Yeah, man.
Yeah.
So I enjoy it. Yeah.
And we both have a Dutch wife.
We both
so,
have Dutch
wives.
So
I mean, we have a lot in common, you know. And you were talking one of the funniest moments in your show for me and my wife was you talking about your wife and a language mistake that she made, and then that's our life too.
Yeah.
You know, my wife is adorable.
Yeah.
I like the.
But the Dutch have such good English, so that when they do make a little cock up, it's doubly funny because you just, you know, because they're so good at it.
And they're so smart. Yeah.
I
mean, I've met people in Holland that speak with like a perfect British accent. You go, I'll go, where are you from in England?
Yeah,
well,
yeah.
I'm from Lanchardy.
Yeah, I mean, just my wife, she's got a slight northern accent now. So like she speaks English as if she's slightly northern, you know, and you know, I'm like, oh, I'll have a chip butty. And you just think, what's the point of going to all the effort of getting yourself a European chick if she's just going to sound like a Bradford fishwife? What's the point of that? My wife doesn't even have the little shush, you know, the little shush shush that Dutch people have, the kind of hush shush at the end of it. She doesn't even have that. That's completely gone. So I think it's time to find a new one. No. I just like the accent though. I think it's a beautiful accent.
Were you performing in Holland? How did you meet your wife?
No, we met on holiday.
All right.
Yeah, we were a holiday romance.
Where were you?
We were in Greece.
Oh, everybody, it's
okay,
hard
where
not
were
to
we in Greece, Tom? Where were we?
Island of Rhodes?
No, we were in Lesbos. We were on the island of Lesbos.
Hey.
It was the most
the
cliched.
The universe came together.
It was the most cliched meeting of two women that has ever happened. We met on the island of Lesbos, which is, it's pretty popular with the with the lady of the Flatter Shoe, and it's that's where we met, and we she was living in Holland and I was living in London, and for 18 months we back and dude between each country.
That's perfect, because my first trip to Greece, I went to the island of Rhodes.
The Rhodes,
because
yeah,
it's got my name on it. So I mean, why wouldn't
why wouldn't
if I was
we?
Lesbian, I would go straight
it's
to
straight
Lesbian.
To where you'd head to, isn't it? Yeah. That's what it says on the label.
What is the mythological story that term comes from?
Okay, well, apparently it was the Greek, Sappho, the Greek poet, apparently lived on the island of Lesbos, and Sappho wrote poems, apparently, for other women as well, and that's where the idea of sapphic loves comes from, love between two women, and I think she threw herself off a rock on Lesbos, which is quite dramatic, but that's lesbians for you. They'll just go throwing themselves off rocks, so yeah. And that lovely story has resulted in lots of quite large German and Dutch ladies visiting there on an annual basis for their summer holidays. So,
is it a nice place?
It's a beautiful place. It's beautiful, yeah. It's a very beautiful island. It's a very, very beautiful island.
I love Greece. I finally went back last year, and I got to go to Santorini and Mykonos.
Oh, nice.
And Athens. There's just so much of it.
Yeah, yeah. Mykonos is where all the gay guys go. Yeah. That's what, yeah. I mean, I don't know if they have the similar story.
Great underwear stores.
I bet they do.
Yeah.
Very supportive pants.
I'm a big fan of Diesel underwear. They had a great shot. It was great.
Tight around the buttocks.
All the, like, you know, Greek knick-knack souvenirs, and then, hey, shit, there's a Diesel underwear shop. This is great.
Fabulous.
Fabulous. But now you what? You grew up in London, right?
No, I grew up, I actually grew up in Ireland. Yeah, my dad's Irish, my mum's English. I was born in Wales, but grew up in Ireland.
All right.
We traveled.
You are Great Britain.
And then we went from Ireland back to England, and then I ended up from there. We went to Glasgow, so we ended up in Scotland.
Holy
so I've traveled
shit.
All over the place. So.
Where in Ireland did you grow up?
Waterford, Dunmore East, which is on the south.
Where the little crystals made?
The crystals last come from Waterford, yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's very pretty, it's very beautiful. And I grew up overlooking the sea, so it was very lovely. So now that I now live in Brighton, and I can still see the sea from.
How old were you when you moved to Glasgow?
Oh, I was about 11.
Oh, okay. So I mean, I always think that wherever you know you went through puberty and learned how to drive is where you're from.
12, 13, Glasgow. Yeah. Except by the time we got there, I got rid of the Irish accent and the English accent. And in Glasgow, that's not such a great thing in the school. In the 80s, I had the shit kicked out of me quite a lot.
To have an English accent.
Yeah. You know, and it was quite strange being that kid that stuck out at school. Because I sounded English, and then I also had alopecia at school, which meant I lost half my hair. So I was the only 12-year-old girl with a comb over.
What's alopecia?
When you lose your hair through stress or whatever. So,
oh shit! Really?
Yeah. So I'd lost my hair. I had an English right. I had an English accent. I'd lost half my hair, and I was beginning to realise I was gay. And at a time when you really want to fit in, you know, when you're sort of 12, 13, you really want to be part of the gang.
Yeah.
I was a balding girl with a comb. with butterflies for ladies. And I was like, oh, God, really? Jeez. I mean, one of those things would have been, but, oh, God, you know, a comb over? A gay with a comb over at school with an English accent in this Glasgow? Yeah, so...
That's a tough town. Even if you were, absolutely perfect and had perfect clothes.
I mean, we were in quite a nice part. We were the south side of Glasgow. It wasn't a rough part of Glasgow or anything. But even still, it was a challenging time, shall we say. It was a challenging time. It's probably those times that make you into the slightly weird, kerneled, introspective person that ends up doing comedy, I guess. So.
Do you think it's because you moved around so much that you became entertaining? That old story that, yeah, I moved around a lot and I had to make friends.
I don't know. I didn't make that because I really wasn't a class clown. I wasn't the class clown. I wasn't the person. I wasn't the go-to class clown person. But it made me more introspective. That's what it made me, you know, because I certainly struggled a bit in school sort of finding friends when I ended up in Glasgow. So you spend more time in your own head. And often that's more entertaining than anything that's going on around you. So, you know.
So when did you get out of Glasgow?
When I went to university, and I went to university in the north of England in York. I did psychology. I say I did psychology. I mostly did bucket bongs.
Bong hits.
Yeah. That was kind of what I did.
What was so wrong with York that they had to go make a new one?
I'm not entirely sure. The new one's lovely. The old one's super. The old one's cold and flat. That's what the old the old one is cold. Have you ever been to York?
No, but I have a niece or cousin that went to a divinity school there. There's
okay.
Like a big,
yes.
Big Christian university.
Yeah. There. Yeah. It's nice. It's pretty. It's pretty. Yeah. And it was very dull as a student. It was only when I got there that I realised I should have gone somewhere like Manchester or Leeds or something with like more of a music scene or something going on, because it was a really, felt quite small.
So what did you study?
I studied psychology.
Oh, like my wife.
Oh,
yeah.
Really?
Yeah.
I didn't really study, though. I did all sorts of other stuff. I got involved with...
It's always great to be involved with someone who studied psychology. Yeah. So, like, when you get into an argument, to go, you know, I think you're really acting out against some issues you have with your father. I'm like, hey, you know, no, I'm pissed off.
Pull it back. No, I mean, my degree in psychology, we learned most about what happens to a confused pigeon if you blindfold it and put it into a maze. And I remember thinking, I don't know how this is ever going to help me in later life. I think I'll just go off and do some drama. I did loads of drama at college. That's what I did. I just did plays and stuff. Plays and a lot of dope.
When did you fall in love with comedy?
Probably at university then. Yeah, at university. Because I started doing loads of plays. And I would usually get the sort of slightly quirky character. You know, I'd be the club-footed maid, you know, who came in on one scene, made people laugh, and then left. That would be my job. So it was around about that time. And then going to see comedy, that's when I started to go and see comedy. And I always remember Joe Brand coming to York. I must have been about 18, 19 when I saw her perform. And she was fantastic. And, yeah, it was from there I started seeking it out more. And then from there, I went to drama school. And again, I just always ended up playing the slightly quirky comedic roles. But I was quite happy doing that.
Do you still do acting?
I have just started again.
Good.
Which I'm very happy about. I'm really happy about. Because the thing about doing stand-up, so it was sort of 10 years since I've done any real sort of acting. And I've been doing stand-up for the last 10 years. And you lose so much fear doing stand-up. You go through all the fears, but over time you realise you've lost so much fear. It makes you a much more brave performer. So when you go back to something like acting, I feel much freer now acting, because I'm not worried about being on stage. I'm not worried about failing. I'm not worried about other things that are often attached to acting. I feel a lot freer. And I think the two things can really complement each other. There are also examples of stand-ups who can't stay within the role, though, and have to come out and be a stand-up. But I found it's really helped me. I really want to do more. I really do. I'm sort of thinking about things of, I don't know, maybe I could... The stand-up show that I'm doing here at the moment, Mustard Cutter, it's kind of physical and it is kind of... It's a bit more theatrical, and I think I might push that even further. Maybe try and write a play.
Not like a one-woman show, like an actual play.
Yeah.
Well, see, I mean, people in this part of the world, you have that luxury.
Yeah.
With Edinburgh. I mean, it seems like, Jesus, what, there's over 3,000 shows here this month.
There's so much.
And like, you know, you can write a play. I mean, not that people will go see it.
No, it could be just you in a cupboard going, damn, I wish I hadn't had this idea.
Shit, I should have stuck with stand-up.
This one-woman play, it's cost me £10,000. yeah. So, but that is the great thing about the festival. It does spark your imagination, doesn't it? It's just so much going on. I mean, the best thing I've seen this year, the thing I've enjoyed most has been Christine the Machine, which I talked to you about earlier, who's a drag, punk, anarchic, hip-hop star from Austin, Texas, And just the madness and boldness of it, I loved it. I just loved it. And you're trying to describe to people what it is, they're like, that sounds ridiculous. And at some point, somebody gets squirted from something that I think comes out of a bottom, but I'm not entirely sure. That happens in the front row. But I absolutely loved it. I love it when I see somebody just committing. she just commits. So,
how would you describe it? Someone was telling me about it, and they said that it starts out with, he pulls a dildo out of his ass.
Yeah, he's just relaxing. Some people slip on a smoking jacket. Others pull a dildo out of their arsehole.
Because I think you would agree that, you know, I've had a great run. It seems like you've had a great run here also this month.
Yeah.
You know, I've read great write-ups about you, and I saw your show. I thought it was fantastic. But in the course of a month run, being on stage every night for 30 days, you're going to have one or two stiff audiences.
Oh, yeah.
I couldn't imagine a stiff night that he would have.
Can you imagine if your audience doesn't go with that from the off, it's going to be a long 60 minutes, isn't it? If there's stunned silence as you pull something out of your anal region, then you've got, if they've come in the Groupon voucher in a confused way, it's going to be difficult. Yeah, and you're right. Of course, during the course of the month, you always have always one or two shows that you come out of going, Jesus Christ, that was hard work. That was such hard work. And it's exactly the same show as you had the night before and you ripped it.
Yeah.
And they loved it. And you left the stage on little sparkly slippers for a nanosecond thinking, I'm a little demigod. And then the following night, you just crawl off like a slug thinking, what went wrong there? What was that? Was that them? Was that me? It can be really tough. Last year when I was here, the worst show I had, I think probably the worst show I've ever had in Edinburgh, was my second night. And my whole front row just looked like the couple from that picture, American Gothic. Just that blank expression on their face, just staring at me like I was some sort of evil wrongdoer that shouldn't be looked at, certainly shouldn't be celebrated, and perhaps should be sent away to think about what they're doing with their life. And it was really, really tough. And at some point during that show, somebody tried to walk out. The only thing that saves that show is as they tried to walk out, they took a wrong turn and he ended up in my props cupboard. And for a beautiful moment, I had to navigate a man out of my props cupboard from the stage to the microphone. Mate, you're in the props cupboard. Get out of the props cupboard. Turn around and come out of the props cupboard. And then he came flying out and then out the front door. But yeah, you can't avoid those. They happen every...
My very first night of the month was 14 people. And oh, Jesus Christ, it was an oil painting. They stared at me. And I thought, oh shit, this might be a long month.
This will be a long month.
But
yeah,
fortunately, it's been great. And then last night, I had the one of the best shows of the month.
Great.
And definitely... And that's the thing about this business. You know, you can never feel good about yourself for longer than 3 minutes in this business.
No.
You know.
No.
Because then I went and did a late show. I did the best of the fest.
Yeah.
It's at that beautiful church on top of the mound. There's 800 people. I destroyed that.
Yeah.
And then I went to some late show and the exact same jokes and total silence.
It's weird, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
It's really weird.
Some of these late shows, that's the thing. You know, you're getting the extra money from being invited to these late shows.
Yeah.
But it can be dangerous to your ego because, you know, you just did your hour show that you've been crafting and, you know, and molding all month. And you go, wow, I really did it great. And then you go to some drunk late night show.
And you get nothing.
Yeah, or heckled and
then
it's pugilistic.
That kind of stink hangs around you for a little bit and you bring that perhaps with you to the next show. You know, the next show you're doing, you're trying to get rid of that stink, that feeling from the last gig. But you know, I did a couple of late night shows last night and one was lovely and one was tricky.
Hello folks. I saw the most beautiful example of British behaviour the other day when I was walking home late at night. I saw two teenagers sitting in a park bench. They were drinking and one of his friends finished his can and threw it on the floor and his other mate turned to him and went, Robert, no! We're binge drinkers, but we're not litter bugs. I thought, how delightfully British is that? That's wonderfully British. I'm so British at times, I've noticed. I don't even use my car horn in this country anymore in case it's interpreted too aggressively. Do you find that? When you hear a car horn, it always sounds like the start of a road rage incident. I thought, do you know what? I think I need a British car horn for my British car. I need a car horn that just goes...
So sorry, I think the lights have changed. No, it was about 5 minutes ago. I'm so sorry. Was that overly aggressive? I didn't mean to be. Sorry.
It's pathetic, isn't it? It's that quirky behaviour. I love quirky behaviour. I was on a plane not so long ago, and I got on this plane. I noticed there was no row 13 on this plane. And I said to the air stewardess, why is there no row 13 on this plane? She looked at me and she went, oh, it's because people think it's unlucky sitting row 13. Which was a surprise to me, because we paid £5 for this flight. So I was thinking luck had run out. We'd made the booking, to be honest with you. Even the pilot had his fingers crossed. But apparently people think it is unlucky sitting row 13. Now, I've done a lot of flying, right? I'm no aviation expert, but I've pretty much worked out for myself, it doesn't really matter where you sit on a plane, does it? If they go down, we all go down. That's usually how it works, isn't it? I have never been on a plane before quite merrily at 33,000 feet with a very, very large gin and tonic and a packet of peanuts, and all of a sudden, row 13, seats A to F, has dropped through the fuselage and everybody else has carried on quite merrily. I have never seen that. People in row 12 turning around going, ooh, that was lucky, wasn't it? That's just gone, isn't it? People in 14 going, look at that, leg room, brilliant. I didn't pay for that, lovely. I love the ridiculous things people say. I was listening to the radio this morning and I heard a woman on the radio saying, I'm actually going to give up the singing career to concentrate on my modelling career. And I thought, wow, it's a career now, is it? A modelling career. I thought, well, let's break it down into its career elements, shall we? You've taken the face and body you were born with, you've stuck it in some clothes, you've done a bit of walking, have you? That's a career. I thought, well, in that case, I've got a modelling career. It's just not going particularly well at the moment, that's all. Yet to take off. I don't know about you, do you ever have those days where you're so ugly you frighten yourself? Come on, it's not just me, is it? You know what I mean? You leave the house, you think you look absolutely fine, and you catch sight of yourself on a passing bus. You're like, what the hell was that? Was that my face? Did you see that on the number 23? That was my face. It's scary. I actually walked into a shop the other day in London. I walked into a shop and I caught sight of myself on the CCTV monitor, right? I looked and I went, oh my God, is that me? Is that me? Because you're at a funny angle, aren't you? So you've got to make sure it is you. So you do the "Is that me?" dance. You're like that. Is that me? Is that? Oh my Lord, that is me. That is me. That is me. Look at that. Look at the state of that. And then I had this awful thought. I thought, if I go missing after shopping in this establishment, that's the last piece of CCTV footage they're going to have of me. I deserve to be found in a shallow grave with hair like that. Look at that! Fatty food I don't understand either. I went into a health food shop recently, not to buy anything, you understand, just to slap a vegan around the face with a steak and leave. It's the little things in life that keep me amused, it really is. I was in there, though, and I found something. I thought, well, this is the reason why the planet is in trouble. We have too much stuff we don't need. I found organic cat food. Organic cat food. Do we really, really need organic cat food? I don't know how many people own a cat, but I have never put food down in front of a cat for it to look at it and go... I'm so sorry. No, don't you be embarrassed. It was my responsibility. I should have told you something. I'm on a strictly organic diet. I can't possibly eat that. I'm so sorry. Listen, don't be... I don't even lick the mice that are from around here. I don't. They're literally full of toxins. They literally are. I get them shipped in from a small farmer in Somerset. They're very small. That's how they're all. Exploding with flavour. They're absolutely delicious. Super. I'm sorry. Is that milk? Again, my responsibility, I should have told you. I am lactose intolerant. I can't. That just, it plays havoc with the tubes. It really does. That never happens. You put food down in front of a cat, the cat will just look at it and go, oh, fantastic. That is delicious. I've been licking my own backside all day. Thank you very much. Thank you.
How long did it take you to write this hour that you're doing now?
Probably... It's hard to say because I usually write throughout the year and then I get to about January, February and I see how I can fit it all together. I'll start thinking about a theme being a very loose thing, and I start thinking about how I can link all this new shit that I've got together, and then I will sit down and write the bits in between, like write, you know. So 6 months? Yeah. Does that sound about right?
Yeah, I'm impressed by it all. I mean, it took me years to write the hour that I'm doing now.
Yeah.
But it seems like a theme is very important. You know, like we saw Felicity Ward's show.
Yeah.
Loved Felicity, and she had this thing about the perception, the iceberg concept, that you only see the tip of the iceberg, but there's this big thing underneath.
Yeah.
You know, like it's a psychological.
Yeah.
Thing.
Yeah.
What was the theme of yours?
I just very loose.
I just remember laughing. I
yeah.
remember a big
good. Then I'm pleased. And
yeah.
Then that's what. Then because I try and make my theme as transparent or as I simply have it there to sort of give me something to stick to while I'm putting it all together. And my tiny little theme or spine was a very simple idea of what it is to be better. So I start off talking about moving to a better area, and then people who, when you get there, there are already people who know it's a better area and they're better than you, and people with more money than them, or you know, better than you, or so it was a very, very loose theme, and it just allowed me to connect all the bits and bobs that I had already, all the bits of material I had together, and put a tiny little storyline through it, which is something that we tend to do more over here, I think, in the UK than
yeah,
American acts.
Yeah,
American,
we never even think about it.
No.
And then when a lot of American comedian friends of mine found out I was going to do Edinburgh,
yeah.
they were gonna like, oh, are you going to do, like, are you going to have some big emotional purge?
Yeah.
Like,
yeah.
And I think that's the concept that, oh, you have to come to Edinburgh, you have to, like, have some
release,
bloodletting
yeah.
of, like, the worst thing that ever happened
yeah.
in your life.
Somebody
in
has
the
to
midst
die.
Of your comedy.
You have to have, you know,
you're
be
sad,
a blackout drunk, have a dabbled in heroin. You know, it's all these things that can and do pop up in shows. And I think we are moving away from it a bit more now. I hope.
I mean, that can be pretty forced, don't you think?
Oh, totally forced. Completely false.
Like, I mean, I would rather see a comedian just go up there and bang out great jokes than
yeah.
kind of shoehorn
yeah.
this sad moment of,
sure, I'm
you know,
absolutely, I'm
my
totally
uncle
with
touched me
that.
In the garage. Once,
yeah. But now here's some material about Snuggies. Yes, it's because it does, it seems forced and it seems crowbarred in at times. And in fact, I fell foul of this a couple of years ago. I can't even remember what my theme was in that show, but there was, always remember there was like 5 minutes in that show that was simply there just to make it make sense, but it wasn't funny. So for that 5 minutes every night, I'd have this look in my eye of, I know this bit isn't funny, and then eventually the audience would go, this bit's not fun, why is this bit here? And I'd be trying to convey it with my eyes, this bit's here just to try and make sense of this show. And then you realise you're cheating yourself and them. You don't need it. You just... So this year, it's been a much looser theme. And I'm glad you didn't even notice
it. Didn't even
there.
Notice
no,
it.
That's great. That's perfect.
My favourite part of your show, I want to point out, but, you know, my sister died of breast cancer. My father was killed by a drunk driver. I don't... To go on stage and talk about those things is goes against the very reason why I became a comedian.
Yeah.
To go up there and have some to cry about the worst shit that ever happened to me. Anyway, I don't know. Maybe I would have had a better Edinburgh show if I maybe I would have been nominated if I'd have, you know, taken 2 minutes to cry.
I'm glad you didn't, Tom, because I loved your show.
Thanks.
And I'm very glad you didn't.
The thing you did that I absolutely loved, and I think any comedian would be able to relate to this. You know, you talking about, don't you feel like sometimes you're the better person in the relationship?
Yeah.
Or like the most important,
yeah.
or however
team
you...
Leader.
The, yeah.
Team leader of the little
and
outfit.
And like, that like if the relationship didn't work out,
yeah.
that you
yeah.
would... be whatever, and then you're like the artistic one and your wife is the smart mechanical
practical
one,
one. Yeah,
who knows
yeah.
how to keep lights on and the bills paid and everything.
Yeah,
I thought that was so funny because that's exactly the relationship I have with my wife.
Yeah.
My wife can do anything.
Yeah.
And I think maybe that's a Dutch thing.
Yeah.
She knows computers. She can fix a broken television. She can, you know, anything like electrical wiring or whatever. I can't do anything.
Yeah.
You know, I can do great artistic things, but I can't...
And the danger is if you're with somebody like that, you'll learn less and less and less and less until one day you're asking somebody to spoon-feed you. Because my wife is very practical. She's very organized. Sometimes I open my drawers of my, you know, my cupboards and all my T-shirts have been... They're like stacks of cards. It's really impressive. They're all the same size. She folds them to exactly the same size. It's a real skill.
And she never worked in retail. She just knows how to
do it. No, she's never been near a Benetton in her life. She's just like that. She's just... She's non-creative. And I mean that, I don't mean that in an awful way, but she'd be the first to admit it. She's not a creative person at all. In fact, sometimes I try and play little games with her and she's going, no, you know I'm not good at that. Don't do that.
What do you love the most about your Dutch wife?
Oh, she's fun. She is fun. We still laugh. We've been together for 16 years and we still laugh. And wow. That's what I love the most. I like it if I make her laugh and tea comes down her nose, then that's joy for me. If you can still do that to somebody after 16 years, then that's joy. And we are just tremendously... We're tremendously fond of each other. We really love each other.
You can see that when you're together. I mean, you both, you just have a electricity jumping off the both of you.
Which is, I think is so lovely, you know. And we annoy the shit out of each other. Of course we do. We've been together for 16 years. And there are times when I'm like, Jesus, why do you have to be so Dutch? You know, because you'll know this. The Dutch can be very straightforward. And I think, well, they'd say straightforward. I would say blunt.
I call it brutal Dutch honesty.
That's the one.
And that's the thing. When people ask me who've never been to Holland, they go, what, you know, should I know about Holland or the Dutch people? I go, they have this blunt honesty that will hurt your feelings.
And they
don't even think twice. They think that that's mandatory that you should say to somebody, oh, your hair looks like shit or, oh, that, you know, you're out. Like, and you would go, what the fuck did you just say to me?
Yeah.
And they think that's their responsibility.
It's quite fascinating when you first encounter it. I remember the first time my wife met my father, which was already going to be a slightly awkward meeting, let's be honest. And my dad had gone out and bought some lovely little patisserie Valerie French pastries. And he said to my wife, would you like another one? And she went, oh, no, they're far too bitter. And my face just dropped. This was the first meeting she'd had with my father. My face just dropped and she saw my face and she went, Zoe, what do you want me to say? Do you want me to say I like it? If I say I like it, I'll get another one. I don't want another one. I don't like it. Which made perfect sense. But in that moment, I was like, oh, wow, that's the difference between, a British person would just sit there and eat. Would eat a turd with hundreds and thousands on, to be polite. It's a lovely turd. Thank you so very much. I'll take some more turd. Thank you. And she's right. Say what you mean. I've learned from her.
Yeah, Americans don't do that either.
No.
We're crippled with politeness.
Yeah. It's ridiculous. You end up falling over each other. You end up falling over yourself. You end up getting...
saying what you really mean. It's always, how are you? Fine.
Yeah.
You know.
That's the other thing my wife will do. She will tell people how she is. And I'm like, oh my God, darling, they don't really want to know. Oh, that's so sweet, but they really don't want to know. My dad just used the expression, you ask them the time, they tell you how to build a watch. It's that sort of thing. Just give the politeness, the pleasantries.
But like from your comedy, what little I've seen that I loved was, yours seems so British.
British, really?
Yeah. I mean, I don't know how you perceive yourself.
Like,
I saw on YouTube a thing you did about just British politeness.
Yeah.
And I had an incident the other night in the men's bathroom. Very British moment. There's a stall, they didn't have the urinals. They had the stalls at the loft bar.
Yeah.
And so, you go in there and you close the door. And the guy in the next stall, he farted. And he goes, oh, very sorry. But he's in a stall by himself. Who's he apologizing to? And it was like, that is like one of the most British things I've ever... To apologize for a fart when you're by yourself.
Yeah. That's the sort of thing where it's, whoopsie, sorry. We do apologise a lot. Because my name's Zoe. I noticed this today. And British people say sorry a lot. I constantly think I'm people saying my name in the street when I'm in the sorry, what? Oh, not me. Okay. Yeah. I think it's sort of a slice of that Dutch honesty and bluntness is quite a good thing to have.
Well, I think one reason people find, and people all over the world find English people so lovable is just that self-deprecating, apologetic
sorry.
Sense of being.
Whoopsie, tits up, here we go. Down the hatch.
I mean, you guys are never not really known for the brash arrogance that Americans have, you know?
No, I guess.
And like in the Olympics, you know, British athletes win something, they're not fist pumping and being dicks. Like.
Yeah, well, we really got into the Olympics. That was the 2012.
The first time your people didn't suck.
We were good, weren't we?
Yeah.
But, you know, for the whole build-up of the Olympics for 2012... Everything in the papers and everything that people mentioned on the street, it was like, oh, we've got the Olympics. Right, watch us fuck this up. We will just make such an arse of this. And, we were setting ourselves up for failure. And then when it was awesome. The opening ceremony, I cried.
I think the best Olympics in the history of the Olympic Games.
When they played Pink Floyd, Dark Side of the Moon, and set off the fireworks, I was like, oh, we are literally brilliant. This has just blown my mind. Yeah. We ruined it, obviously, when we got Paul McCartney at the end to sing Hey Jude, like a little old lady who got confused and wandered into the stadium. But that ruined it for me. But Dark Side of the Moon, that darkness of that song and that beautifully British Pink Floydness and the fireworks going off, I was like, oh, this is awesome to use. I've started to use the word awesome a lot more since then. But my brother's married to an American and...
Where's she from?
She's from Alaska.
Holy shit.
Yeah. I've been to Alaska.
It's gorgeous there.
Oh, it's beautiful. Yeah. It's absolutely beautiful. It's nuts, but it's beautiful. I love the way my brother drove us up to Fairbanks, Alaska. And, in the middle of winter, and you're driving through the woods and the landscape's incredible. You see nothing. And then out of nowhere, just a saloon bar with the girls in neon. And you're like, where the hell from? Where have these girls come? Just imagine some... slightly feminine grizzly bear having shaved off most of the fur in a bikini, because it's an incredible place. But because my brother married an American and spent a lot of time out there, his use of language has changed. It's quite interesting. He's far more positive in his use of language than I am, and the cynical Brit in me kind of goes, oh, it's ridiculous, it's backslapping and you hee-hawing at everything. But you know what? I tried it once, just that, hey, good job, good for you, you go for it, you game high. It does make you feel better. It does make you feel better. You go, oh, yeah, I can see why you do this. It's great.
Yeah, it's the energy you put out into the world type thing.
Yeah. But our default mode is just self-deprecating, miserable, damp twat. That's what we are. Again, look at our weather. I think a lot of that has to do with that. We're soggy.
Yeah, but I mean, so much, literature and, like you're saying, music. I mean, it's amazing the amount of music alone that's come off this little island.
Oh, incredible. It's amazing. It is incredible.
So, I mean, we're relatively the same age. I'm 5 years older than you. We don't need to give out any numbers. But, I mean, did you just grow up popping pills, going to great concerts and raves all the time?
Not raves. I was quite involved in the clubbing scene in London in the 90s.
When ecstasy was quality.
Well, it was, yes.
Yeah. When ecstasy was quality.
And I had a few DJ friends and stuff.
See, that's you and I when we're, in our 70s and 80s. Yeah. That's our old folks. Remember when ecstasy was great in the 90s?
When we sit
you
down
could dance
around the
all
old,
night.
We'd sit around the piano to play out some old tunes that'd be very different ones. Do you remember this one, Doris? So, yeah, I had fun in the 90s in London. Apparently. I'm in photographs. No, I enjoyed that side of things very much. Yeah.
Were you already doing comedy then, right?
No, I didn't start until... I didn't start comedy until I was 30. So I started quite late. Yeah, I'd gone to drama school. I'd done little bits and bobs of fringe things. And then, yeah, about my 30th birthday, I started doing comedy. And then we moved away from London as well. So that's also, that life changed. And you get too old for it as well.
What, the partying?
The comedy, yeah.
Yeah, that's true.
You do?
That's true. I haven't... done no. anything in a long time, and I stopped drinking this year.
Oh, good. Well done. Yeah. It's good. I'm still very much attached to the alcohol. I do like a drink.
Yeah.
That's very much a British thing as well.
No, I'd say it's human. Yeah. Everybody likes a drink.
Yeah.
I just busted my head open in Philadelphia and got 6 stitches there, yeah.
Oh, nice.
Just started to take a little break.
Yeah.
It's like an athlete. You realize you're not as good.
Yeah.
You lost a step on your game, you know?
Well, I misstepped out of a taxi already this year in Edinburgh. I've got tubby grip on one leg because I rather drunkenly dismounted a taxi, missed the pavement and dragged a limp foot.
No, that's not bad.
It was fun.
There was no blood, right?
There was no blood. But I am slowly falling apart over the course of this festival. There's a little chemist shop at the end of my road, and each week I've been in there for different things. First week it was a cream for dry skin, and then it's been decongestants, and then antihistamines, and then finally tubey grip. And then I'll be like, have you got something I can just sew myself together with? The woman is the same woman every day on the counter as well. She's like, hello, what would you like this time?
You walk in and she goes, okay, yeah. What's wrong with you now?
Do you got any methadone? It's week 4. We're done.
What are some of the most inspiring performances you've ever seen in Edinburgh? You've been coming here how many years?
I've done 6 solo shows. And I've probably been coming about 8 years doing bits, like, so 8 years altogether, probably 8, 9 years. I saw Joan Rivers a few years ago in a sweaty, stinking, shitty hot room in Edinburgh. And she was glammed up to the nines. And it was a midnight show in this stinkingly hot, disgusting plague pit of a room. And she was fabulous. And she would have been...
Why would she buy you a little tiny room?
I don't know. I don't know why they put her in there. But I love the contrast of her glam against the sort of backdrop of plague pit. It worked beautifully for me. She was great. She would have been 71 at that point or something. And she was just absolutely brilliant. And just giving it gutsy... You know, because she's a lot older than I am, and I get sort of midnight at the festival. I'm like, oh, I'm tired, I need to go lie down, put some slippers on. And she was just giving it loudly. The Russian physical theatre that I saw, Bahir, about 6, 7 years ago, I think changed my life.
There's really?
A group, yeah, it's a group called Derevo, and they are quite dark. And my friend took me along to see this thing. She went, come and see this Russian physical theatre group. They're doing a thing about Faust. I was like, everything in that sentence sounds horrific. There's nothing about that that sounds appealing or joyful in any way sensible. And she went, it's an hour and a half long. I was like, oh, good God. I went with her. It started with a man running out into the arena with stark bollock naked, except he had a bell around his penis and a pair of horns on. And I was like, this is going to be the longest hour and a half of my life. By the end, I was weeping and I didn't want it to stop. It was.
That's what I would have thought when Christine pulled a dildo out of his head.
By the end of that piece, I just did not want to stop. It was the most incredible thing I've seen. And I've loved Christine. I just love anybody who commits. I've seen so little stand-up this year. It's been a bit disappointing.
But how important is this for you to make your mark in Edinburgh? Is it as important as it used to be? Because, like, this year was the big change where the main newspapers didn't send all these critics and stuff. But, I mean, artistically, like you're saying, I found this month to be incredibly inspiring. And then I've seen so many shows in little tiny rooms.
Yeah.
You see someone giving the performance of their life at 2 in the afternoon. And then just brilliant theater pieces and comedians. And it's impossible to come here and not be inspired.
Yeah. Yeah,
I would come here as a tourist.
Oh yeah,
to come and check out shows for a week. It's absolutely brilliant.
Yeah,
but what about the importance for you?
I think as somebody who's been doing it for a little while, you've got to come up with and know why you're coming up, or at least have some aim in coming up. And this year I was really excited because I was doing the play as well, and it was giving me a chance to perform in a different way, and I was really excited about doing that, and I'm so glad I've done that, and I think it's influenced my stand-up as well, made me think differently about how I want to.
That's a lot to take on. Two shows every day.
Yeah.
And the play is called Outings.
Yeah.
So do you out gay people who are in the closet?
No. It's, wouldn't that be great if it was like this deal or no person. Deal?
And you call them, you put their photo up on the screen.
Open a box and like, hey, we all knew, didn't we? We all knew. Well, we're here to tell you. Absolutely. No, they're real people's coming out stories. That they've been submitted, and some of them are very funny, and some of them are really sad and very moving and thought-provoking.
Wait, what's the saddest? Anybody? I mean, I always love to, you know, lots of gay friends of mine, you know, they'll tell the story where they come out to their family, and the family's like, we've known since you were
eight. Yeah,
you
know, there's a few of those stories.
Why did it take so long for you to find the bravery?
But then there's a story my cast member Andrew performs about a young boy who can't tell his parents he's gay because he knows that they're extremely homophobic, and he starts looking for friends online, and he meets somebody who is older than him because he's 14, 15, older than him, and takes advantage and abuses him, like, mentally and physically, and so he ends up in a very abusive relationship with this guy, being raped on a regular basis. And it's, you know, it's this true story, this guy who the writers met, and that was his coming out story, and it was quite brutal and shocking. And
Jesus.
And recent as well. You know.
Has he been able to have good love stories?
He's only still young. It's a recent story. So, you know, because within the arts world, you know, we live in a much more open, liberal environment normally within the, you know, the arts, you know, and we assume that, you know, being gay is fine. Everybody's gay in the arts. Everybody's gay. Look at them gaily skipping over there and doing their little gay play. And, you know, you forget that out with that, there are still pockets, you know, within the United Kingdom and all over the world where it's not cool. And it's still very difficult for people.
Yeah, I mean, it always amazes me that the mentality of the United States.
Yeah.
We're still so far behind, and it's, I mean, everybody's got a gay relative by now, certainly.
Well, you think so, wouldn't you? Yeah. Statistically, there must be, you don't have to go that far back to sort of find one.
Right.
Oh, Uncle Joe with his cravat. Oh, yes, makes sense.
Don't you think, like in the United States now, don't you think history, did you hear the story about that I did in my show about the famous gay person?
Yes.
That, when I was very young, got me to his apartment.
Yes,
made
yes.
Made this very strong move on me. He's still a closeted person.
Is he?
And he's pretty notoriously known as a gay person among performers because he's so lascivious.
Yeah.
I think history is not going to be kind to gay American people that remained in the closet during this period.
Yeah.
When, you know, people are really fighting
for
their rights and to be recognized, you know, as, you know, proper citizens by the law.
Yeah.
So, I mean, we seem so many years behind Europe. When did Sweden get gay marriage? Like 69? When did Britain have gay marriage?
No, Sweden weren't that, it wasn't that long
weren't
ago.
Were they the first?
No, I don't know if they were. In fact, in Sweden, up till I think about the 60s, homosexuality was deemed a mental illness. My friend.
Wow.
I've got a friend who does material about this. So people phoned in sick for work. Wow. That's how they. I can't come in. I'm gay. And I think it's my friend Marcus Bergman who does material about that. Certainly one of comedian friend of mine does material about that.
I love Marcus.
Yeah. And it's such a. So they weren't that. Progressive. It's countries like Argentina and Uruguay that have got same-sex marriage that you kind of go, God, if they've managed to do it, you know, deeply Catholic countries without that much of a hoo-ha. You know, South American countries that have got same-sex marriage and the States is still struggling with it as an idea. It is peculiar. But then you've got all the federal and state laws, don't you? It all becomes quite... It's difficult to understand, so... certain states will allow it to happen, but then it won't be a federal law.
Well, it was like, you know, I mean, it was illegal for mixed race marriages to happen until like the late 60s.
Yeah.
I mean, and then it's like in segregation. I mean, something has to be, once something's a federal law,
yeah,
it, when they leave it to the states,
yeah,
laws, that's when things keep getting rejected. But
yeah,
once something's made a federal law,
that's it.
It's supposed to,
it's in.
So, I mean, that's kind of one of my disappointments with Obama, that, you know, he definitely has left the gay community hanging.
Yeah.
Who helped get the guy elected?
Yeah.
I mean, you know, he should have already made the stamp. Hey,
yeah,
this is a federal law now and everyone can go fuck off.
Yeah. And why hasn't he?
That's what I'm asking.
Yeah. Why hasn't he? I mean,
they helped. These are
and
the
people. And now in his final term, now is the time, isn't it?
Yeah.
Surely that should be his parting card. That should be his, here, take this as a gift from me.
Thanks.
Yeah.
Appreciate everything you did for me.
Yeah. Yeah. When you look at, I mean, you only have to switch on the news and see all the shit on the planet, you know, not encouraging love seems like it's totally the wrong thing to be doing. Not encouraging, you know, people who want to be together to form families together and relationships together. And
it's a lonely planet.
Yeah.
You know, wherever.
Then why? It's just, there's so much hate that we should surely be sprinkling droplets of hope on love. That's what we should be doing.
Yeah, and my mother's from Argentina. You know, you mentioned her.
Oh, yeah.
I've been there 4 times. It is a very macho society.
Yeah, yeah.
And women, you know, the men never clear the tables
after
dinner. Like, certain things are a woman's work.
Yeah.
Like, you know, the 50s black and white American television. But they, you know, have the gay acceptance.
Yeah.
So, I mean, even in this macho, tough guy society, they've figured out
a way of dealing with working it out and working it through. I mean, yeah, it's I don't know what
I have
fear
to tell
is.
You the line I told the guy Mark who's doing the Quentin Crisp one-man show. I had a great conversation with him yesterday and we were talking about Oscar Wilde and how his time in the Reading Gaol, really broke him. You know, and it was the Marquess of Queensberry. He was having the affair with his son.
Yeah.
And the Marquess of Queensberry is really, you know, he had Oscar Wilde arrested and put in that jail. So because I love Oscar Wilde so much, I never adhere to the Marquess of Queensberry rules when I fight. I always fight dirty in honor of Oscar Wilde.
Pinching and biting because of Oscar Wilde.
And I gouge, you know.
Yeah.
This one's for Oscar. But what about, how long have you lived in Brighton? Brighton, it's been too long since I've been in Brighton.
10 years I've been down there.
Jesus, what a great place.
Yeah. I love it.
Yeah.
I love it. And it's where I feel at home.
Artsy, cool, gay. I mean, that's why I moved to San Francisco in 1991.
Exactly,
that's what I was looking for.
People have sort of said it's got that kind of, well, you know, it's not quite San Francisco, but...
But San Francisco isn't San Francisco anymore.
Yeah.
It's been taken over by the geeky internet people. I mean, like, gay people had flavor, and the artsy people had flavor, and even the dirty deadhead hippies had flavor. There's this really homogenized...
Is it hipstery?
Internet. Well, yeah, you got your wax-tipped mustache people, but it's guys in, like, Google windblade... what are those things called? Windbreaker jackets.
Yeah.
You know, the little nerdy guys.
Nerdy guys. Is that the future, Tom? We're just going to be left behind... I'll just get myself a Google monocle. That'll be the cool thing to get, a Google monocle. When the Google glass is too much, just a Google monocle. And I will keep one eye on reality.
So what about Brighton? What's the comedy scene like down there?
It's good. It's really good. It's small. I mean... London is on the doorstep, and you've got, God, I mean, you know, London's got so many clubs going on every night of the week, and
cash money. Fucking love London.
2-3 gigs a night.
Yeah.
A lot of Brighton acts will go up to London and work, and then, you know, you can go home on the same night. It's that easy. It's doable. It's commuterable. Within Brighton, there's I've run a gig down there for the last 10 years called Bent Double, which is a monthly comedy show. It's kind of aimed towards more of the gay crowd, in that I book acts that I know they'll enjoy, if that makes sense. I have in the past called it a gay-friendly night, but that sounds ridiculous, like there are places that are actively gay-unfriendly. But
gay-approved.
Yeah, gay-approved. It's got the gay stamp of approval. This night has been pink-approved. So I've done that for the last 10 years, and that's great fun. That's in a place called Comedia. I don't know if you play.
Oh, yeah, Comedia, yeah. What's his name? I worked with him in Asia last year.
Stephen Grant.
I was going to do it in February when I was here.
Yeah.
But I had to pull the gig. Yeah. I had to get to Los Angeles for some television stuff.
Yeah, it's a good night, good venue. And the people are smart. And lovely. And
there used to be a gig years ago that I did on those arches by the beach.
Yeah, that's
right
gone.
On the beach.
The Zap Club.
That was it.
That's before I started doing comedy.
That was a great room.
I've heard legendary tales of it, yeah. But I never got to play there, yeah. But no, it's good, and it's got a lot of... I mean, it's artsy. It's like you say, it's artsy, and there's people knitting their own vegetables and living out of yurts. It's that sort of a place, and it's... It's great. It's buzzy. It's lovely. It's got a big music scene. And
Fatboy Slim lives there.
Fatboy Slim, who I often see when I'm running down the beach front. Nick Cave lives down the road from me. That's quite nice. It's quite nice to go out and see Nick Cave walking down the street.
Yeah.
See
him at the liquor store.
Yeah, yeah.
What's he getting?
Yeah, yeah. He always looks so dapper. Oh, my God. He's such a handsome man. And Dave Gilmore lives down the road. That's... So I love it. I love being part of that. Well, not really part of it, but I love being amongst it. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
I love it.
I Googled you and I was looking at your Wikipedia.
Yeah.
And it said in 2009, you were one of the most influential gay and lesbian people
of
Great Britain. Yeah. So I want to know, what have you done wrong in the last 5 years?
I know, I just slipped straight off.
You've lost your influence.
Do you know what? Slipped. Didn't even slip slowly, Tom. It wasn't even like a, whoop, she's dropped a couple of places this year. It wasn't like a sort of hip parade. Ooh, she's slipped.
Right.
I just slipped straight off. It was straight on, straight off.
Oh, she dropped from 20 to 43.
Do you know what I think it was? I think I knew the editor that year. I think that's influenced my appearance. Yeah. I haven't featured since. I've got to creep back up into those.
Yeah, you gotta.
I don't consider myself an influential gay in any way, shape, or form.
You need to start having the pro gay Ugandan parade or something.
That's what I need. Yeah, being an influential gay sounds like you going out actively encouraging people to join up, doesn't it? Could I influence your decision on homosexuality? Have you considered letting Jose into your life?
Be the new Jehovah's Witnesses. That'd be great.
Yeah. Door knocking. Yeah. Good morning.
I brought some pamphlets I'd like you to look at.
Yeah.
You ever been to Greece?
Leave your little book on Sappho. Enjoy.
Watching your show, it seemed like you're close with your father. No?
Yeah,
Who's the funny person in your family?
The funny person in my family? I'm trying to think. I don't think I mentioned my father in my show. I did a thing recently where I did a thing for Chortle recently where I came up with a playlist of things that... comedy that my dad influenced he enjoyed when I was a kid, and that certainly influenced me as I grew up. I used to love watching with my dad. My dad's not a comedian anyway. He's not a voluntary comedian. He's an involuntary comedian, if you know what I mean.
Right.
Yeah. He's a little bit eccentric, which I love about him. He's the only man I've ever known who's gone skiing wearing an offshore survival suit and a pair of marigold washing up gloves. Yeah. He was in Norway and they went and decided to go skiing. That's all he had in the car. An offshore survival suit and a pair of washing up gloves. And you know how swanky and she skiing can be, you know? He's there in a fucking... I love that about him. Doesn't give a shit. Doesn't care. But I developed my love of comedy probably watching it with him. Pink Panther movies, Peter Sellers, Dick Emery. classic British humour.
Dick Emery, never heard of him.
Oh, love Dick Emery. 60s and 70s and 80s, I think he went into. Caricature comedy. He used to do a lot of women. He used to do this character called Mandy, and it was all very innuendo. And the punchline was, you know, that somebody would ask her something, and it would have a double meaning, and it was, oh, you are awful, and then she'd slap them, but I like you. And I wouldn't go to bed at night until my dad had stood me on the end of my bed. I was probably about 5, and I would say to him, oh, you are awful, and my dad would go, poof, but I like you, and I'd fall into bed, and it was our equivalent of a bedtime story type thing.
That's beautiful.
It was lovely, yeah. Yeah,
doing a little slapstick.
Yeah,
skit.
A little slapstick before bedtime. And
then he'd step on a rake on his way out of the room.
And, yeah. And then slip on a banana. And I would sleep like a baby. Fawlty Towers as well. I don't know whether that did.
Oh, yeah, everybody, that's all time classic.
And.
You know, there's a restaurant in Edinburgh that.
Yes, do the experience.
Which. Cost a fortune, and why I didn't do it.
I don't know why you'd do that, but yeah, I mean, I love the comedy, but I don't know why you'd do that. And the Gene Wilder films and Mel Brooks films, Young Frankenstein,
Abby Normal.
Oh my god, it's one of my favourite films. I love Marty Feldman in that film.
Yeah,
that's that ridiculous, over the top. Clowny caricature, I totally love. And I know this face will slowly turn more into Marty Feldman as I get older. In fact, if I wear a black shroud, I could be the... That's my casting in later life.
Wasn't Marty Feldman's wife one of the inspirations for Absolutely Fabulous? Wasn't it her...
I don't know if it was her. I know it was... It was a PR lady who I believe is the mother of Josh Howie, another comedian. I think she was one of the influences for Absolutely Fabulous. Yeah, but I'm not sure about the Marty Feldman connection.
Okay, what do you think? What's next now for you?
I don't know. I genuinely don't know. I'm gonna have a holiday.
You leave Edinburgh. You leave after Edinburgh. The whole year builds up to this.
And
you
then,
know.
Poof. Who knows? I'm going to really make an effort this year to do more acting, because I have so thoroughly enjoyed it and I've had very nice, positive feedback. And I think it's something I should pursue, and I'm excited about doing that. How and in what way at the moment, I don't know. But that's bubbling around in my mind. And... the next stand-up show I write, I want to keep going along those lines and make it slightly more theatrical, more fun. Yeah, because I think I've really enjoyed doing this year. It's been good. And that's the secret, I think, of having a good show. You've got to enjoy it, because it's a long, old run. And if you don't enjoy it, by week 2, they can see you're not enjoying it. You've got to make something that you enjoy performing. Otherwise, you're all going to have a long...
Yeah, well, there's nothing worse than seeing a bitter comedian on stage or someone who's not enjoying it. And I honestly mean it. You were one of my... I saw probably 50, 60 shows, probably, you know, 30, 40 comedian shows this month, and you were absolutely one of my favorites.
Thank you very much.
You contain the original energy of joy
in your
being and in your humor. And I absolutely loved it. I mean, that's why I wanted to have this little chat with you.
It's been an absolute pleasure meeting you as well. I really appreciate your kind words. It's very lovely.
I mean it. Yeah, I'm sincere.
It's very sweet.
What is the greatest advice you've ever been given as a comedian?
I think it's really cliche, and it's probably something that everybody's heard a million times before, but be yourself. And then the closer you get to what you are, the better you will be on stage. And it's advice has been told many times to many people, but I think, yeah. Otherwise, all you'll ever do is give a sort of rough copy of something else. You just got to connect with yourself, and that's what we're constantly trying to do.
In closing, is there any words of wisdom or advice that you have for the people of the earth?
For the people of the earth, seek joy in little things. Seek joy in little things each day. It's something I try and do. And when you do, they sort of mount up, and before you know it, you've got a collage of happiness around you. Paste all the little things together, and you'll get yourself a beautiful picture eventually.
Beautiful. I usually end there, but now I have one to throw in one extra question for you. What advice would you give anyone who is going to have a Dutch wife?
Prepare your relatives. Have a word with them first, so no. That they can be assured of a soft landing.
That's perfect. Zoe Lyons, long may you run, sister.
Thank you, my love. Thank long you so you much.
When I was 21, my mother said, only a doctor for you. When I was 22, she said, all right, a lawyer, CPA. 24, she said, we'll grab a dentist. 26, she said, anything. If he could make it to the door, he was mine, you know? What do you mean you don't like him? He's intelligent, he found the bell himself. What do you want? This is all rubber, let me tell you, which is very good, because if I fall down, bounce right back up. And I'm...
My sex life has changed. Can we talk here? My sex life has changed. In the beginning, we'd have, like, you know, we'd make love, and we'd sit up and we'd talk. Now, 10 minutes after we make love, he goes right to sleep. I'm always screaming, please, keep your eyes on the road. I mean, it's just... Well, I'm telling you, I've got my stupid contacts in. Hold on. Okay, sorry about this. Their album is called License to Ill. That's a stupid name for an album.
Well, first of all, I want to know why Kim Kardashian brought Adam Lambert and pretended to change.
Take a good look at this face, America. Give me a close-up. Like that close. Get back, you. This is the face of comedy.
If you want a real job, honey, there are a million things you can do. But what we do is not a job. Sounds so stupid. What we do is a calling, my dear. We make people happy.